Good day, podcast listeners of the Thomas Jefferson Hour, and thank you for listening, and thank you, 1776 Club supporters, for supporting the show and making this possible. We really appreciate it.
This was fun. We did listener questions. We always enjoy listener questions. They come from a wide range of backgrounds. Some of them are sort of Jefferson 101, new listeners.
Yes, and we've been taken to task a bit by—
Who would take us to task?
Well, that Stephen guy was on. He kind of, I said, you know, sorry.
Oh, wait, do you ever actually get to my questions?
Yeah. And it was like, you know, I'm sorry. And he said, well, try harder.
I want to apologize to a listener, may I?
Yeah, who?
We didn't come up in today's program, but I got a letter. And I take this actually very seriously. And the man said he loves the show and he admires our work and, you know, he's learned from it and so on. But he said, you know, from time to time you talk about something called the Wendover Death March, and I get it that that's all in good fun, but my father was actually in the Bataan Death March, and I wonder if you don't think that's maybe possibly a little insensitive.
Well, what do you think?
I wrote back and said, of course, you know, that— The Bataan Death March is one of the most horrific things that happened during World War II.
Right.
Thousands of people died. It was a horrible human rights violation by the Japanese Imperial Government.
Then?
Well, but I think the point is this is a 4-hour hike up a little mountain in Idaho where no one really suffers. You know, the worst that's ever happened is a blister. And so it's all in good fun, but you see the point.
Yeah, I do.
It's very— If your father was on the Bataan Death March, you probably don't find that as amusing as I do. My father was a banker. So fair enough. I take that very seriously.
Yeah,
that doesn't mean we won't do it anymore.
I'm glad you brought it up.
But it's important. So this week it was questions, and one of them was on a question that you've never been asked before, which I love. And that was, Jefferson is a scientist, okay, but in what sense? Did he actually conduct scientific experiments?
Mm-hmm.
And we kind of had a wonderful little discussion of the discovery of oxygen by Joseph Priestley, which is, I think, one of the most fascinating stories ever told. But we love these questions because I've been reading books about Priestley and oxygen, and I'm just fascinated by this, how humans see through the seeming sameness of things. I wonder why that is.
Uh-huh.
And so Jefferson wasn't quite that sort of a laboratory experimenter. He did a little of that, but he mostly was a botanist.
He sure kept up on it, though.
Well, he knew, and he corresponded with these people, and he wrote fan letters to scientists that he really liked, like Edward Jenner, who discovered the smallpox vaccine, or David Rittenhouse, whose planetarium called an orrery was fabulous.
We had an extended conversation in a previous show about Priestley, and a fascinating character.
Amazing. And, of course, he's also the father of the Unitarian Church. Joseph Priestley.
Which is why Jefferson was so attracted to it?
Yeah, so he and Jefferson are corresponding really carefully about, well, what's the nature of Jesus? Was he the Christ? Is it fair to ask these questions? What's the political ramification of even raising such questions? And Priestley was always pushing Jefferson to write up Jefferson's own views of these things, and it led to the Jefferson Bible. Jefferson produced his cut-and-paste version of the New Testament in answer to provocations by his friend Priestley. Mm-hmm. Priestley helped give Jefferson confidence that he could write about these sacred questions and that he should be courageous, that he, Jefferson, should be courageous enough to take these questions on privately, not for public consumption. This is kind of taboo land, calling into question. If I said publicly on the Jefferson Hour, I do not believe that Jesus was the Christ, that would hurt some people's feelings. People feel very strongly about these things, and so we have to be very thoughtful, even in the 21st century talking about them, and imagine how much more it was the case in Jefferson's time.
Yeah, you're saying they were too.
Much more, because then we were closer to the time when faith was central to the human experience. Today, it's central to some people, but our culture is largely secular. Mm-hmm. That wasn't so then. And so Jefferson was rightly respectful and cautious when he came upon these subjects.
What you're saying is words matter in both of your last comments.
They do matter, and you know, wisdom is calling things by their right names, said Aristotle.
Hmm.
Wisdom is calling things by their right names.
Well, it was a fun show, and let's let people have a listen to.
Yeah, I like these programs. The more questions we get, the better. I think dumped a little on National Architecture Week And I made jokes about National Cabbage Day and National Asparagus Day, and that probably wasn't – but that's true. That Jefferson thought that would be frivolous.
Yeah, that was Jefferson, not you.
But still, I dumped a little on
– you're getting a little character smear there.
Yeah, National Rutabaga Day, you know, stuff like that.
All right.
Yeah, Dairy Day, Dairy Week, Pickle Day, you know, that stuff. All right, listen now to this podcast edition of the Thomas Jefferson Hour.
Good day, citizens, and welcome to the Thomas Jefferson Hour, your weekly conversation with President Thomas Jefferson. Mr. Jefferson is portrayed by the award-winning humanities scholar, author, and creator of the Thomas Jefferson Hour, Mr. Clay Jenkinson. I'm your host, David Swenson, and seated across from me is, I'm pleased to say, Mr. Thomas Jefferson. Good day, sir.
Good day to you, my dear citizen.
Mr. Jefferson, before we begin, I owe you a thank you.
How's that, sir?
You have been so gracious in the past few weeks. I brought to you some difficult things for discussion, you know, things that I know you're not as happy to talk about, and yet you've been such a gentleman and shared your insights with us, and I thank you, sir. I'm afraid I didn't thank you enough the last time we spoke.
Well, there are two things to say about that. First of all, I do want to live in a robust democracy, and that means that there will be conversations that nobody wants to have or that make us uncomfortable, but that doesn't mean that they're not important conversations to have. But personally, my own temperament is a sort of a timid one, and I said in a letter to Abigail Adams once that I'm more likely to retire from a conflict than to jump in and to wrestle with another person's ego or to accept the abusiveness that comes in that kind of disputation. So I'm a harmony lover. My motto is take things always by their smooth handle. And I'm not temperamentally really fit for the very robustness that I'm talking about. But I do understand it in principle, and I realize that we're unlikely to thrive as an American republic unless we can engage in this sort of dialogue. It certainly is better than dueling or shooting each other with muskets or waging war against nations that happen to upset us from moment to moment.
Agreed, Mr. President. And I thank you. I wondered if this week you might be willing to answer some questions that have been sent to you by your many listeners, sir.
Of course. I corresponded with the American people. I had secretaries, but I seldom used them. In fact, Meriwether Lewis was my first presidential secretary before I sent him off on his famous mission into the American West. But I was the first president to correspond on a routine basis with average Americans whom I had never met. If a letter came to me, addressed to me as president of the United States or to me as the owner of at Monticello, I didn't ignore it if I didn't know the person. I sat down and tried to write out a rational answer.
Let me begin with a subject I know that you enjoy very much, Mr. President, that is architecture. We received a letter from Rebecca, and she was noting that April 9th through the 15th is National Architecture Week. It was named so by a previous president, and it was, as you can tell, placed during the week of your birthday. Now, I know you did not like to celebrate your birthday or call attention to it, but I thought it was fitting that this was so.
First, let me say that I do love architecture, and I said putting up and plucking down is my favorite amusement. I regard architecture as important for a whole range of reasons, but personally, I regard it as just pure delight, and Monticello was never really finished, and it was never really meant to be finished. I'm constantly changing my mind about what appeals to me aesthetically or what is useful as an architectural structure. And I was never contentious to build a house and then to live in it for the rest of my life. In fact, I remodeled almost every space that I was ever in as Secretary of State, as the Vice President of the United States, as the Ambassador to France. Whatever role I held, I found a place to live, often a rental property, and then I immediately set about remodeling it, sometimes at great expense. So this is a kind of a mania with me. It's a hobby that's gone to some extremes.
You enjoyed tearing down and building up again.
Of course. And when I came back from Europe in 1789, one of the first things I wanted to do was to rebuild Monticello. I had seen some things in Europe that really impressed me, particularly the use of domes. in some new buildings in Paris, and a building called the Hotel de Somme so delighted me that I used to sit out on a chair and watch them building it because I was fascinated and I wanted to incorporate the dome as a structure in the United States for the grain market that I hope to help design for Richmond, but also for my primary home at Monticello, the home that I lived in from 1770 to 1784 was not a dome structure. It was Palladian, but there was no dome. When I came back from Europe, I tore down much of the house, and then by around 1806 or so, the dome was complete there.
Rebecca writes, as a practicing architect, I wonder at the legacy each president has regarding architecture, whether it be through the development of presidential homes, presidential libraries to honor their legacy, or buildings that are somehow tied to their presidential terms.
I doubt that many presidents have had much to do with architecture, frankly, probably mostly in their presidential libraries. Now, presidential libraries did not exist in my time. If that idea had existed, it would have been a very useful thing because I had a library of about 7,000 volumes. By 1812, 13, and 14, I knew as an older man that there was no point in keeping it, that it was too precious a library to remain in private hands, that it needed to have some home that was not a private one. And so I sort of looked around. And eventually I sold it to the Congress of the United States to replace the library that was burned by the British during the War of 1812. The British burned the National Capitol and with it our Congressional Library. Madison was president, as you know, and so I wrote to him at that point and said, my library really needs to have an institutional home, and it might be appropriate that it become the seedbed of a universal library at the Library of Congress. And Congress, after a long and somewhat politicized debate, did choose to buy my library for a fraction of its worth, and it became the basis of the great American Library of Congress. If there had been a presidential library available to me, I would have, of course, put the books there.
You would approve of the idea of presidential libraries, then, I take it?
Indeed, yes. I think that every president's papers are important. As a citizen and as a public official, I worked hard to preserve documents. I made it a point to collect as many historic documents from the colonial period and the early state period of Virginia as I could. They were actually in a state of deplorable corruption. They had not been well stored. They had not been well curated. They hadn't even been well sorted. Many of them were literally crumbling and falling apart or eaten by rats or destroyed by mildew. And so I took it upon myself to gather those papers and to preserve them and to bind them and, where possible, to get them printed. And so this work as an archivist was of great importance to me. And I actually developed a form of storage device. It was canvas or burlap that was impregnated with oils so that it kept those documents at the right humidity and kept them from becoming so dry that they would fall apart. And these were sealed bags. And it's not that I invented them. I just found this to be a useful storage device. And when Meriwether Lewis, my secretary, went up the Missouri River in 1804, he took the key documents, including his universal letter of credit, this sort of blank check that he had. He put those essential documents of his expedition into these sealed burlap oil treated bags so that nothing could go wrong with documents that might have saved his life in extremity.
Lastly, Rebecca wants to know, and remember, as I said, Mr. President, she is a practicing architect. She wants to know how Monticello was received at the time it was built by the public. Was its style applauded? Did people scrutinize it?
Most people never saw it or even saw an image of it. You know, this was a time of much greater isolation and privacy than you can understand in your own time, but...
Well, it did have an effect on at least your neighbors, did it not, sir?
My neighbors were impressed, of course. There were some eyebrows raised. You know, why can't Jefferson live like a normal human being? Why does he insist on living on top of a mountain? That's not very practical.
But it was so unique compared to, say, Mr. Madison's house or Mr. Washington's house, was it not?
Madison's house bears some resemblance to Monticello, perhaps not as whimsical a place as Monticello. I think it's fair to say that my neighbors felt that I was a little ahead of myself, that there was something a little bit notional or even pretentious about building a Palladian villa on top of a mountain. I think people, it's not that they looked down on me for it, but I think they felt that I might have a lack of basic good sense, certainly a lack of economic good sense in building and then rebuilding and rebuilding such a place. May I quibble for a moment?
Certainly.
I see that a recent president has named National Architecture Week. I don't know why the president of the United States should name National Architecture Week or National Women's Month or National Black History Month or National Cabbage Day. These things, I think, are a mistake.
Harmless, sir.
No, they're a mistake. It gives a grandeur to government that it doesn't deserve. Government needs to deliver the mail. Government needs to protect our harbors. Government needs to settle disputes. Government needs to do what it does. But nobody at the Philadelphia Convention authorize the government to name National Carrot Day or National Book Day or anything else. This is a silly waste of presidential time.
What was the name of the society that you were named president of?
The American Philosophical Society.
About the same time you were vice president.
Yes. I was one day before I was sworn in as vice president, I was installed as the president of the American Philosophical Society.
Had Mr. Adams decided that the American Philosophical Society needed some special recognition, would you have fought that?
Yes.
You would have.
Yes. Because the president of the United States is to do what is enumerated in Article 2 of the Constitution, and the legislature should be spending its time on questions of foreign policy and tariffs and taxation and law and order and not on National Asparagus Week. I think there's just something wrongheaded, silly, frivolous, even corrupt about government descending to this realm, even to architecture.
Well, Mr. President, please take this in the spirit which I stated. There's an English author who came up with a phrase that I think would apply to your attitude, sir.
What is that, sir?
Bah humbug, sir.
Oh, please. No, we mustn't descend to frivolity in government.
But to recognize achievement, sir.
I've stated my point. If we disagree, we must disagree as rational friends.
Well, I'm trying to find a way to make you see the point of others, and I'm afraid I'm failing.
I mean no disrespect for Rebecca, an architect, and I honor that women are now a member of that tribe. But I don't think that her life is made any better by National Architecture Week.
Thank you very much, Mr. President.
You're most welcome, sir.
We're going to take a short break, and we'll continue this conversation in just a moment. You're listening to the Thomas Jefferson Hour. Welcome back to the Thomas Jefferson Hour, your weekly conversation with President Thomas Jefferson. And President Jefferson has been gracious enough to agree to answer some listener questions this week. And Mr. President, I appreciate your time and your thoughts.
You're so welcome, sir.
I do have one question here that I hope you take in the right spirit, sir. It comes from a Stephen Vaharin, and he wants to know about the slaves that you owned. You and most of your neighbors owned slaves.
Well, slavery was not universal in Virginia of my time, but it was very widespread. And in the planter society in the large estates like Monticello, it was unfortunately an essential form of labor. We could not have possibly found enough white laborers in the United States or England or anywhere else to do all the hard work at places like a tobacco farm or a sugarcane farm.
Well, that, sir, is a well that we could fall into and never come out of. So rather than go there, I will respect this gentleman's question and ask it. He wants to know about one particular slave, one that became famous due to some, I believe you called it, yellow journalism.
I'm feeling a migraine headache coming in.
We'll get through this quickly, sir. Mr. Callender made her famous, and he wants to know how Sally Hemings came to Monticello.
Sally Hemings came to Monticello with her mother. The Hemings family belonged to my father-in-law, John Wales. And when John Wales died, my wife, Martha, inherited 135 slaves. And part of that inheritance was the Hemings family. The Hemings family had served the Wales family for several generations. And now Betty Hemings and her children, including Sally Hemings, came to Monticello. They were owned by my father-in-law, then they were owned by my wife, Martha, and me.
So that wasn't so difficult, Mr. President?
Well, as long as we stay on the facts that could be ascertained from my farm book. But I don't think that anyone asks about Sally Hemings who isn't of the opinion that she had a very, very special place in my world. But I did not purchase Sally Hemings. I did not purchase any member of her family. In fact, I freed a number of members of her family, including her brother, James Hemings, who had been with me in France. He had come to France where I had placed him under a master chef so that he could learn the art of French cookery. And he did come back along with Sally Hemings. She didn't come initially to France. She came while I was already there in place as the American ambassador. She brought my younger daughter, Maria, or Polly, over during my five-year tenure there. And at the time, Sally Hemings was 14, I believe. And then she stayed with me from 1787 until 1789, when I came back to the United States, and I brought James and Sally Hemings back with me, and I brought my daughters, Martha and Maria, back with me to the United States. And thereafter, the Hemings were tied specifically to Monticello, although I did free James. James had come to me in France and said that he had been doing a lot of investigating, and he was aware that in France, slavery was outlawed, and therefore by international law, I could not own slaves in France, that he was free, and that he was under no legal obligation to come back to the United States with me because the French government would recognize him as a free human being if he chose to assert that, and that I would be without legal recourse to bring him back to America. And so he put this to me and said that he and his sister Sally wanted to know why they would possibly come back with me when they would be slaves in Virginia, but free in France, in Paris. And so this was, as you might expect, a considerable embarrassment to me. And I sat them down and said the following. I said, James, if you come back and teach somebody else the art of French cuisine, if you teach somebody else what you've learned in Paris, I will then free you and I will give you some startup money to go to Philadelphia or the place of your choice and to live as a free black man. I make that promise. But you must come back for a time, however long it takes to teach another Negro slave at Monticello the art of French cookery. And he agreed to that. And I said to Sally Hemings, his sister, his younger sister, if you come back and live your life as a domestic servant at Monticello, as a maid, essentially, sort of the mistress of my wardrobe, perhaps, if you come back and do that, I will free your children. When they become adults, when they become 21 years old, I will make sure that any children that you might have are freed. And I was actually equal to that promise. I allowed two of her children to walk away from Monticello. They were white enough to pass, and they simply were allowed to literally walk away from the plantation and be absorbed into the larger white society. And then two of her sons outlived me, but in provisions of my will, they were freed too. And so four of Sally Hemings' children were freed when they became adults, two by manumission and two by benign neglect, just allowing them to walk away because of an agreement that I made to the two Hemings, Sally Hemings and her brother James Hemings, in Paris, when they challenged me with the illegality of slavery in French society.
Mr. President, we have a question from a Stephen Huckabee, and he wants to understand the revolution. He writes, I do understand some of the causes which led up to the revolution, but maybe not fully. Did we really, meaning the United States, have to revolt in order to let England know how we felt about their treatment of the colonies? Was war our only option?
Oh my, I have to say I'm sorry to see what I presume is an American citizen ask this question. We did not want to rebel against Great Britain. I was born an Englishman, although in an English colony. I regarded myself as a citizen of England, as a British subject. I was brought up to have moderate respect for the king. The king in Britain is a parliamentary creature. He's not an absolutist king. His power comes from the Constitution, and Parliament is supreme. But I grew up to respect, not revere, but respect the sitting monarch of the kingdom of Great Britain. We were glad to be English in culture, in speech, in trade, and we would have remained a colony in perpetuity had we been treated correctly by the British Parliament and the British Ministry and the British Crown. But the fact is that they engaged in systematic degradation of the rights of us as British citizens. They treated us as mere colonials. They taxed us without representation. They regulated us when we didn't have any seats in the British Parliament, when we insisted that we would not abide by any laws to which we had not at least had representatives to represent our interests. They said that we were virtually represented, that we didn't have to have actual representatives, that there were people who thought well of our interests and they would protect us, that there was a virtual representation by our status as colonials under the British Crown. We rejected that. We said emphatically that if you take money from my pocket, somebody who is my representative agent must be in that body, in that Parliament, that House of Commons, to make sure that you do so fairly and that there is an equitableness about taxation and that you aren't targeting us for no good reason or beyond our capacity to pay. So we did everything in our power. We remonstrated. We passed resolutions in our colonial systems. We corresponded with the British Ministry. We published pamphlets. We attempted in every possible way to compromise. And finally, we realized sometime in 1775 or so, for some it wasn't until July of 1776, but we finally realized we will never be able to work this out peacefully with the British Crown or the British Parliament, that the only way that we are ever going to get a due respect for our rights is if we declare independence. We hope that when we declared independence, they would just let us go. And if they had let us go, we would have wanted to enter into a Commonwealth relationship with Britain. We weren't averse to being British. We were just averse to being tyrannized. But they didn't let us go. King George decided to fight to keep the colonies. We did win the war, of course. It was a long and mostly a war of attrition, but we won, and then our independence was grudgingly accepted by the British system in the Treaty of Paris of 1783. But for this gentleman to think that we could have worked it out, believe me, we bent over backwards. And I will say this, that no American wanted more to remain under the British system, the British sovereignty, than I did. And I would have done anything in my power to find a way to work out the differences that we had with Britain. I found it extremely painful to rebel. I'm a harmony lover at heart, for one thing, but I also think that war is such a melancholy and wasteful thing. And usually a war ends with the reestablishment of the status quo. but millions of lives have been lost or millions of dollars have been wasted. And so I was so saddened to be forced into rebellion by a mulish king and by an insensitive parliament and a corrupt ministry. But they did it, and they forced us into the stance that we took. And once we had crossed that line on the 4th of July, 1776, we could not turn back. And the loser was Great Britain, not the United States.
So the simple answer to his simple question, was war our only option, is?
War was the only option.
He also wonders if this was treasonous and what made it treasonous. Well, that's sort of self-evident.
Depends on who you ask, of course.
Right.
I believe that humans are born with rights. In other words, part of your birthright as a human being is that you are born with the right to life and liberty and property and public pursuit of happiness, that these are not things granted to you by a benevolent king or by a parliament that's in a good mood, that we are born with inherent rights, and that any government that respects that is a just government, and any government that tramples upon that is an unjust government. And so we would have stayed, but you must honor the rights of man. We would never have rebelled had conditions been better. So we exhausted every possible means of nonviolence and were forced into a state of rebellion, which we didn't seek and did not want. But once there, we knew that we were doing the right thing, because not only were we fighting for our rights, but we were fighting for the rights of humankind. In other words, the whole world was watching. And if we vindicated man's inherent rights and said we will not accept a system that doesn't respect them, we were doing something on behalf not only of everyone in America, but everyone in the world, and theoretically everyone who would ever be born into the world.
Moving on to our next letter, Mr. President, it comes from Wesley Cheney, and he writes, "Dear esteemed Citizen Jefferson, I've heard it said that you were a scientist," and he says he's familiar with your gimcracks and your record-keeping and your observations, "but he's ignorant of any experimentation that you may have done in the matter of, say, Joseph Priestley or Benjamin Franklin. Did you partake in any laboratory experiments, and could you please share some examples, sir?"
Well, not in the fullest sense. I did have a chemistry set, and I dabbled a little there, but I didn't do anything of the in the magnitude of Priestley. Priestley, for example, discovered oxygen. It's a fascinating story, but Priestley was able to look at air and realize that there must be constituent components in it, and he discovered oxygen.
And you were aware of this, sir?
Oh, yes.
How did you find out?
Well, he published about it, and if I may, I'll quickly explain just how he did it. So this was a time when we had created a vacuum system. So a glass bulb, a glass jar, could have the air removed until it was something of a vacuum, and this began all of it. So what he did was he put a candle, he lit a candle, and put a glass jar over that candle. And then he waited. And as you know, if you cover a candle with a glass jar containing air, that after a short time, the candle will go out. And so he wondered, well, why exactly did the candle go out? And what he discovered was there was still as much air as there had ever been in the jar. So there was no loss of air, but somehow the air could no longer support fire. He thought, okay, there's something then. There's some subordinate constituent of air, some element in air that has to be there for fire to exist. What might that be? Well, then he put a candle under a jar, but he also had a plant there. And the plant was producing something that sustained the candle over a longer period. Anyway, by these forms of experimentation, of isolating different phenomena in what we like to call air, he discovered oxygen. And when he discovered oxygen, it opened the door to the taxonomy of air generally, nitrogen and helium and all sorts of sub-constituents of air. Before that, nothing but air. After Priestley, with this very careful set of logical experiments, he isolated oxygen and presented that information to the world. That is pure science using what would in your time be very primitive equipment, but using genius to make breakthroughs on behalf of human ingenuity and happiness. And Franklin, the famous kite experiment, Franklin wanted to know, whether there was an electrical component to lightning, he assumed there was, and whether that electricity could somehow be harnessed by humans. And so he literally took out a kite and let it go up into a thunderstorm, and then watched as the stream of electricity came from the cloud to the earth. And when he discovered that, of course, it was quite a dangerous experiment, but when he discovered that, he realized that indeed lightning was electricity and electricity lightning. This led him, for example, to the lightning rod. So if a thundercloud is going to discharge its power in an instant, it can burn down a house or a church. But if you have a lightning rod, a piece of metal there that has a trailer all the way to the ground, that discharges that potential electrical energy more gradually, and so it prevents that building from being struck by a sudden burst of lightning and burning to the ground. So these are actual experiments. I didn't really do much of that. My experiments were horticultural. So I planted different types of peas. I had seeds from the Lewis and Clark expedition and other expeditions. I tried seeds that I had gathered in France or in northern Italy and tried them at Monticello. I grafted. I did hybridization to a certain extent. And so most of my experiments were experiments in botany and biology and not in what you would call physics or astronomy.
Mr. President, I've handed you Mr. Cheney's letter. Perhaps you'd like to read the tail end of it for us, sir.
Oh, how kind of him. He says, "Finally, sir, I am delighted to share that this spring I will be leaving the miasma of Tidewater, Virginia, for the cool and foggy Alaskan coast. I have lived for too long amongst too many people parked too closely together in the city of Norfolk. I am taking a summer job as a bicycle tour guide in bucolic and damp Skagway, Alaska. I shall be reading the journals of Captain Cook in preparation. I intend for my journey to be a Jeffersonian experience. I remain fondly your fellow citizen of the Republic of Letters and the American Republic, Mr. Wesley Cheney."
Do you have any other suggestions for reading he might do, sir?
I think he should read the journals of Lewis and Clark, Captain Cook, of course, and certainly in so far away a place, a weather log, because if you compare the daily weather in Skagway to that in Charlottesville or Norfolk, we might get to the point where we can predict weather.
Well, so we should both, sir, wish him a bon voyage and safe travels, and to keep us informed with his journal.
A bicycle tour guide.
I'll explain that during our break, Mr. President.
Interesting, very interesting.
And we do need to take a short break, but we'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to the Thomas Jefferson Hour. Welcome back to the Thomas Jefferson Hour, your weekly conversation with President Thomas Jefferson. Now, your weekly conversation with the gentleman who created the Thomas Jefferson Hour, the man seated across from me now, Mr. Clay Jenkinson. Good to see you, sir.
Hello, my friend David Swenson.
Oh, it was a close one with Jefferson.
Maybe
just about.
You were edging.
Almost set him off.
Why did you do that? You get a letter from someone who wants to know about.
Oh, I'm only reading it.
What? How did you meet this Hemings? How did you meet?
Who said it was Steve Verheyen?
And so you see that.
I hope I got his name right.
What do you think? He's a genealogist? Do you think he's just interested in the slave populations at Monticello? No, this is a prurient question. And you're lucky because remember, on a previous program, when you brought it up 7 or 8 years ago, he walked out.
I was persistent, but I was a gentleman.
But you, in fact, you backed away from taking that. Okay, so they were in France with you. You think you can ask an objective question about Sally Hemings?
You know, it's time we revisited that in a serious way, but not today.
Not today.
Because I have just been consumed as of the last 3 months with that whole episode, trying to understand and—
Which episode?
Been reading a number of different books about slavery at Monticello. And let's not go there because it's a dark hole that, like I said—
But you know what I have? Let's do this program because I have a series of observations to make that—
The books you mentioned, what was it? What were they again? You said there were two books
Oh, two books
reading.
By Harari. He's an Israeli, Oxford-educated scholar, historian. One is called Sapiens, and the other is called Homo Deus. And I cannot recommend them too highly. Homo Deus and Sapiens. We'll put them on the website.
Yes. But I'll look for them.
But I have some new thoughts about slavery that relate to Alexis de Tocqueville and North Korea. And so let's do a program on slavery.
And I look forward to that.
Me
but
too,
now,
yes.
sir, on to questions from your listeners. Questions directed to you, Mr. Jenkinson. First one from Russell Ives. He says, thank you for a truly inspiring radio program. What a nice guy.
Indeed.
I have read several books about John Adams, and this past Tuesday, listening to the show, I realized I had no idea what books to read about Thomas Jefferson. What books on Mr. Jefferson can you recommend? And most importantly, what writings, titles, and treatises should be pursued to appreciate his thoughts? Now, you get this a lot, but it's always good to come back to it. I believe we have a list of recommended reading on the website.
But let me say about, if you want to read Jefferson, still the easiest way to do that is something called the Viking Portable Jefferson. You know, there's the Viking Portable Hemingway and the Viking Portable Steinbeck and so on. And when I first started out doing this 30 years ago, I read the Viking Portable Jefferson, and it really laid down the baseline understanding that I have of how Jefferson saw the world. It was edited by the great Merrill Peterson, and it's a really outstanding one-volume compilation of a fraction of what he wrote. So that's where you start. And Jefferson himself said, David, that if you want to understand my life, you probably read my letters, that my letters are, in a sense, the best starting point for anyone who wishes to know who I was, because they reveal me, Jefferson, on whatever is passing in front of me. And so, you know, you see a lot that way. So that's how I would start. And then the same Merrill Peterson wrote, in my view, the best biography of Jefferson. You're now reading it.
Yeah.
Thomas Jefferson and the New Nation.
You can pick it up and just in any time, pick it up any place, and it's brilliant.
I've been rereading it as we do Jefferson 101, and here's what I find, and maybe this is admitting too much, but when I'm reading Merrill Peterson, I say, oh, that's where I got that idea. Oh, that's where that's why I see Jefferson that way.
You're an honest man.
So he actually taught me how to think about Thomas Jefferson, and probably if I'd read Elf Maps, two volumes on Jefferson, Passionate Pilgrim and A Strange Case of Mistaken Identity, he's a much more conservative historian, I might have seen Jefferson in quite a different way. You know, we are so dependent upon the treatment of these major figures by their best biographers.
And also, you said his letters are a great source, and I would heartily agree. And the great thing about his letters is you can find them for free online. And
approximately 26,000 letters, one of the great epistolary artists of all time. And if you go to the Library of Congress site, you can see the actual letters, the digital facsimiles of his correspondence.
It's kind of become a sport for me to look on the internet for books about Jefferson that I didn't know. And in fact, I just emailed you one the other day, the Jefferson Reader.
Oh, yes, yes.
I've read one of the best descriptions of Jefferson's farming methods that I've ever read in there. I'm sure you're aware of it.
It's a fascinating subject. But going back to Russell Ives' question, there are so many great books about Jefferson. I mentioned Elf Maps, two volumes. I've been rereading them. They're terrific. I also think that Joseph Ellis's books on the Founding Fathers, but particularly his study of John Adams, Passionate Sage, which is largely about the Adams-Jefferson friendship, and his book, American Sphinx, The Character of Thomas Jefferson. They're whimsical, they're wry, they're a little hard on Jefferson, but he sees Jefferson as a sort of comic figure in some respects, but they're excellent. Joseph Ellis is maybe the greatest scholar of our time on the Founding Fathers, and his books are really always, in every sense, worth reading.
Good question. Thanks, Russell.
But I think you said we have on our site a list of recommended books.
Yeah, I believe we do.
JeffersonHour.com.
Yes. This may be our last letter to answer this week. We'll see, because I suspect you can go on and on.
I would never go on and on.
Ryan McKenzie, you have the letter in front of you, sir. I am a huge fan of the show and greatly appreciate the Jefferson Hour's place within the greater conversation of our world and politics.
What could be a
today?
Nicer thing to say than that? Thank you so much.
And he does
Ryan
go on
McKenzie.
To say another.
The deepest gratitude give you and David. How about that? My heartfelt thanks for all the work that you do. I believe in the barn. All right, vindication. Crisler, are you listening?
And you and David can both talk about gardening as long as you want.
My first time meeting you was as a junior in high school back in 1994, watching you present as Jefferson at a Hyatt Hotel in Incline Village, Lake Tahoe. It had a profound effect on me and for my development as a student of history.
Well, what a lovely thing to say.
My question is, how has your relationship with Jefferson directed your life? How did your life develop, not only as a scholar, but as a human being throughout your lifelong intimate study of the man? And in what ways has your understanding of him changed throughout your career? Well, as you say,
okay.
That could be a long question.
It could be.
And he's made me immeasurably better. That's all I can say, that if I could have hitched my wagon to X, to any figure in history that I might have wanted to study, it was a more or less an accident, David, that I happened upon Jefferson. I was actually invited to look at Jefferson and to portray him once for one night only. And what I discovered was that Jefferson embodies in many respects, not in all of them, but the world that I want to live in. In other words, I want to live in Thomas Jefferson's America. I want to live in a rational country, a country that prizes books and the liberal arts. I want to live in a country that believes that science is our guide. He called it our oracle. I want to live in a country that attempts at social equality and extending due process and the rights of man to every living human and maybe beyond the limits of humanity. I want to live in a world in which harmony and civility are the principles of our public life rather than rancor and shaking of fists and mean-spirited talking points and innuendo and character assassination. I love the agrarian, Jefferson's view that a human with his hands in the soil is almost automatically a better human than somebody whose hands are not in the soil. I love the Lewis and Clark expedition. So in almost every respect, becoming acquainted with Jefferson and eventually, I hope, mastering him has made my life much, much, much more than it otherwise would have been. And I can't thank Everett Albers, the man who pushed me into Jefferson, enough, because I mean, I know it sounds crazy, but I can imagine my life without Mark Twain in it, and I can imagine my life without Emily Dickinson in it, and I can imagine my life without John Milton in it, although that's hard, but I can't imagine my life without Thomas Jefferson at the center of it, and so I feel so fortunate that I've had the chance to try to make sense of this remarkable man, America's Da Vinci, but also a man who in so many respects embodies the paradoxes of American life.
We have time for just a couple more questions. Can you give me a short answer to a short question, sir?
Possibly.
Michael Stewart writes, he saw a television program where George Washington and John Adams were dining and complaining about their teeth. And he wonders how Mr. Jefferson's teeth were and what practices of dental health did people have at that time?
Well, as usual, Jefferson was an innovator. He brushed his teeth, and he picked his teeth. He, in a sense, flossed.
How do we know that?
Because we've seen the instruments and we have the letters. So Jefferson, as you might expect, was a very fastidious man. He took personal hygiene seriously. He, of course, wanted to keep his teeth because the creator has given you teeth. But if you lose them in Jefferson's time, you're like George Washington. Washington had nothing but trouble with his dentures. It's a famous and hilarious story, but to put it in a nutshell, they never worked. And he had one set of dentures that had springs, and the springs were so powerful that if he relaxed his mouth sprang open. And so Washington always had to clamp down on his teeth to keep his mouth shut. So Jefferson saw all this. He saw that teeth were a real issue. I lived in England before dental hygiene really took off there, and teeth were an issue then in the 1970s, as late as that. But Jefferson realized what every dental hygienist says, floss every tooth you want to keep. So there you are.
We have time for just one more letter.
One more, sir.
One more, and it is from Kevin S., and it's about Thomas Jefferson and Alexander von Humboldt.
Oh, that's a show. That's a series of shows. Humboldt is a German Prussian explorer, polymath, who spent years in South and Central America, who became one of the greatest explorers of his era, who wrote 20 volumes based upon his extensive exploration, and went to Washington to meet Thomas Jefferson.
His question is in connection with The Invention of Nature by Andrea Wolf, who, by the way,
we
you
need
said,
her on this program. A fabulous
you said
book.
We were going to get her on
she
the program.
She has a book on the transit of
set.
Venus. She has this book on The Invention of Nature, a magnificent new account of Humboldt's work.
We don't have that show set up yet, but we do hope to contact her and get her on. So I'm going to leave it at that because we'll...
Well, that ties into today's essay.
It's time for this week's Jefferson Watch.
Thank you, David. Countdown to the eclipse. Start planning. A total eclipse of the sun will occur on Monday, August 21st, 2017. These things don't happen very often. A few occurrences in a lifetime and not always where you can observe it without helicopters and speedboats. The total solar eclipse is going to cut a narrow swath across North America through a corridor in Oregon, Idaho, Wyoming, Nebraska, Missouri, Kentucky, Tennessee, and South Carolina. Mr. Jefferson's only option would be to travel to Asheville, North Carolina, a distance of 351 miles from Monticello. That's about 2 weeks on the road for Mr. J each direction, if there were roads in that part of the American West of his time, and the Sage of Monticello, as you know, was not much of a camper. Since he could not live without wine, could not live without books, could not live without fine cuisine, could not live without his word processor, the famous polygraph, it would be quite an excursion indeed. A total solar eclipse is the sort of thing that thrilled the men, and some women, of the Enlightenment. They were so impressed by the stunning regularity of the solar system that they decided that God must be a kind of perfect Newtonian celestial mechanic, a planet spinner. A small, quite infrequent number of celestial events, eclipses, alignments of planets, returns of comets, and transits of Mercury or Venus across the face of the sun, remind us of the clock-like precision of the solar system. Thanks to astronomers and mathematicians like Copernicus, Johannes Kepler, Tycho Brahe, Galileo, and above all Isaac Newton, between 1500 and 1727, we figured out, well, they figured out, how the solar system really works. To put it in the simplest terms, thanks to them, we can predict a total eclipse of the sun and determine the places on Earth where that phenomenon can be seen to full effect. When such moments like the August 21st eclipse occur, those who love this sort of thing get to experience the thrill of the orderliness of the universe. The Greek word cosmos actually means order. To observe an eclipse or a transit is to somehow bow down to what Jefferson called nature and nature's God, to sing a song of praise to the magnificence of the clock and of the clockmaker, unless you think the perfections of the celestial sphere are merely the yeasty and random stuff of the Big Bang. Jefferson was a deist. He believed that the Creator was the inventor of gravity. Jefferson loved these Newtonian moments. In anticipation of the transit of Venus for June 3, 1769, Jefferson undertook an extensive correspondence with David Rittenhouse, Andrew Ellicott, and his other friends in the mathematics and astronomical community. He ordered special equipment, including an expensive chronometer, in other words, a clock, prepared for the great moment. If you miss it, it's more than 100 years till the next one, with his usual attention to detail, and then it was cloudy at Monticello. One of his early biographers, James Parton, said that Jefferson could, quote, calculate an eclipse, survey an estate, tie an artery, plan an edifice, try a cause, break a horse, dance a minuet, and play the violin. Come to think of it, I doubt that I can do any of those things. But thanks to the internet, I know precisely when the 2017 eclipse will occur, and I can choose from a plethora of American locations from which to observe it. I know what I'm going to be doing that day. Two of my favorite people are eclipse groupies. One of them is the great David Nicandri, formerly the director of the Washington State Historical Society, more recently the author of an excellent book called River of Promise, Lewis and Clark on the Columbia. His manuscript for a book on Captain James Cook is now ready for the press. You will recall that Mr. Nicandri and I observed the most recent transit of Venus in June 2012 from our respective perches, he near the Pacific coast, I on a bluff in northwestern North Dakota. I was there with another of my dear friends, one Cathalea Robinette of Sacramento. She wore funky glam queen sunglasses for the occasion and a stunning fluorescent green t-shirt, and we shared breadfruit. That's what Captain Cook did in Tahiti in 1769. I had ordered the dehydrated breadfruit from a website called 1-800-ARE-YOU-REALLY-THAT-NERDY. Whether Cathalea will be available for this celestial circus, I know not, but she's the kind of woman who can eclipse an eclipse. But I do know about Douglas of Oxenford, one of my oldest friends, Douglas Holmgren, an X-ray laser physicist with a PhD from Stanford, a fellow student at Oxford in the late 1970s, has invited me to join him and other science geeks for the eclipse. I'm planning to drive out to Oregon somewhere and join these solar tailgaters, along with David Nicandri and his merrymakers, on August 21st, which, by the way, is just 3 days after Meriwether Lewis's 243rd birthday. Lewis and Clark observed the much more common lunar eclipse at Fort Mandan on January 14, 1805. It was 8 below 0. You have to really love the Enlightenment to find that one amusing. You can be part of this Jeffersonian moment. Let us at the Jefferson Hour know where you plan to be on August 21st, 2017. Send in your report, including photographs, observations, drawings, and video clips, and we'll find a way to incorporate them on the show and on our website, jeffersonhour.com. I'm serious, but you'll have to order your own breadfruit. I'm Clay Jenkinson.
The Thomas Jefferson Hour is brought to you each week by Dakota Sky Education. The program is distributed nationally by Prairie Public Radio. President Thomas Jefferson lived from 1743 to 1826, and this program presents his views. President Jefferson is portrayed by the award-winning humanities scholar and author, Clay S. Jenkinson. To obtain a copy of this or any past show for a $12 donation, please call 888-828-2853. Again, that number is 888-828-2853. This program is also available online at jeffersonhour.org and on iTunes. If you'd like to correspond with President Jefferson or submit a question for him to answer on the program, please visit the website at jeffersonhour.org. The Thomas Jefferson Hour is produced at Mokoche Recording Studios in Bismarck, North Dakota. Music by Stephen Swinford. Thank you for listening. Please tune in again next week for another thought-provoking, historically accurate program through the eyes of Thomas Jefferson.